Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris today. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 1st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Turning to the weather forecast first thing, this coming from KCRG. Calmer weather will be around for a few days, with less wind and gradually warming temperatures. Today, look for highs to reach around 40 in the north, with low 40s in the south, under a partly cloudy sky. As high temperature settles in with us, winds shift to more out of the south. They'll still be somewhat breezy, but lacking the intense gusts of Tuesday. We have another cool night on the way, as temperatures dip into the 20s yet again, but the overnight temperatures moderate over the next several nights. Look for a bit of a warm-up through the rest of the week, as highs return to the 50s for many on Thursday, and all across the area on Friday and the weekend. A few chances for showers begin Saturday into Monday, though many dry hours will exist during this time as well, as rain chances remain quite limited and scattered. This is also an early reminder that this coming weekend marks the end of daylight savings time. We will fall back and set clocks back 1 hour. Temperatures stay in the 50s during the weekend into the start of the following week, dropping back toward the 40s by midweek next week. Now let's turn to local news on the front page of the Courier. Iowa polls, Trump strong, Haley tied with DeSantis. Former President Donald Trump still holds a commanding 27 percentage point lead among likely Iowa Republican caucus goers. But support for former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley has swelled in what has become a heated battle for second place in the leadoff caucus state. A new Des Moines Register NBC News Mediacom Iowa poll shows Haley pulling even with Florida Governor Ron DeSantis for a distant second place behind former President Trump among likely Iowa Republican caucus goers. The poll of 404 registered voters in Iowa who say they plan to participate in the January 15th Republican caucuses, conducted October 22nd through the 26th, found 43% of likely Republican caucus goers choose Trump as their first choice for president, up slightly from August, despite Trump's mounting legal challenges. The former president faces 91 felony counts in 4 criminal cases in Washington, New York, Florida, and Georgia, and could potentially be looking at years in prison if convicted. DeSantis and Haley are now tied for second place, with 16% of likely Iowa Republican caucus goers selecting them as their first choice for president. That makes for a 10-point jump for Haley since August and a 3-point slide for DeSantis. South Carolina U.S. Senator Tim Scott stood at 7%, down from 9% in the August Iowa poll. Former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie stood at 4%, down from 5%. Ohio entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy held steady at 4%. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum rose from 2 to 3%. And former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson rose from 0 to 1%. Haley's surge has been fueled by swelling support among Iowa independent voters, according to the Iowa poll. The former South Carolina governor doubled her support with independents, which propelled her to second place tie. Trump, too, picked up support, leading DeSantis with independents 33% to 12%. In August, Trump and DeSantis were nearly evenly split among independent caucus goers, who made up 21% of the poll's respondents. Despite lagging Trump by 27 points as the first pick among Iowa Republicans, DeSantis matches Trump in the combination of those who say they're actively considering supporting him in the Iowa caucuses. Both are at 67%, according to the Iowa poll. A super PAC supporting Trump's third bid for the White House began airing attack ads in Iowa over the weekend against Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, a primary rival for the Republican presidential nomination. First reported by the New York Times, the ad by Make America Great Again, Incorporated, aims to paint DeSantis as insufficiently conservative less than 3 months out from the first-in-the-nation Iowa Republican caucuses by accusing him of supporting statehood for Puerto Rico based on a 2018 bill DeSantis co-sponsored in Congress. The bill created a task force to codify the process for applying for statehood, but it did not grant Puerto Rico statehood. Meanwhile, Trump took a similar stance as DeSantis in 2016. DeSantis's campaign pointed to a statement Trump made as a then-candidate in his first run for the White House, in which he also supported a process for Puerto Rican statehood. While an issue that resonates in Florida, which has a large Puerto Rican population, many Republicans oppose statehood, suggesting it would help Democrats electorally. DeSantis's campaign, citing the New York Times reporting, heralded the apparent shift in strategy by the Super PAC, which abandoned negative ads slamming DeSantis at the start of the summer as part of a pivot to a general election posture and a focus on using paid media to attack President Joe Biden, sending a message that Team Trump saw DeSantis as a fading threat. According to a Monday filing with the Federal Election Commission, Make America Great Again, Inc. spent about $958,000 on Iowa TV ads, including production costs placed over the weekend. More than 95% of the ad buy and production costs went to opposing DeSantis. Only about $37,000 went to supporting Trump, and $3,000 to opposing Biden. Quote, after months of pounding their chest that they already had the race won, Team Trump is now being forced to publicly admit that Ron DeSantis is climbing in Iowa and is a dire threat to their chances of securing the nomination, unquote. Andrew Romeo, communications director for the DeSantis campaign, said in an emailed statement to the Courier, Des Moines Bureau, quote, at a time when Israelis and Americans are still held hostage by Hamas, while millions of Americans are suffering under high inflation, and when our southern border continues to be invaded, Team Trump inexplicably has decided to levy false and hypocritical attacks on Ron DeSantis about Puerto Rico, Romeo said. Former U.S. Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Ben Carson endorsed former President Donald Trump on Sunday, along with dozens of Iowa faith leaders. Carson, a retired neurosurgeon who ran for president in 2016 and was tapped by Trump to lead the Federal Housing Agency, introduced the 2024 presidential candidate to the stage at a Sioux City rally on Sunday. Quote, we can fix our country. We can make America great again, Carson said at the rally. And President Donald J. Trump is the person to do that, unquote. Trump's campaign also released a list of more than 100 faith leaders backing his candidacy, including some current and former Iowa legislators. Dick Green, a minister with John G. Lake Ministries from Linn County, said in a news release that Trump, quote, has proven he's able to do what he says, so why would I try anyone else, unquote. Now let's read the weekly crop report. Weather should improve as harvest nears completion. Dateline Des Moines. Moderate rainfall during the week slowed harvest in some areas as Iowa's farmers had an average of 4.2 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Fieldwork included harvesting row crops, completing fall tillage, applying fall fertilizer, baling stalks, and hauling manure. Quote, widespread rain fell across Iowa over several days last week, and a cold blast brought the first measurable snow to northern Iowa, said Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagg. Quote, the weather forecast looks drier over the next week, with temperatures slowly climbing to near seasonal, offering farmers an excellent window to harvest or complete other field work, unquote. Corn harvested for grain reached 77% statewide, one day ahead of last year, and 8 days ahead of the 5-year average. Gilbertville woman wins $50,000 prize in Iowa lottery scratch game. Dateline is Clive. A Blackhawk County woman has won a $50,000 lottery prize. Paula Lutkin of Gilbertville won the 22nd top prize in the Iowa Lottery's $50,000 Super Crossword scratch game. She purchased her winning ticket at Casey's in Gilbertville and claimed her prize Friday at the lottery's Cedar Rapids regional office. The $50,000 Super Crossword is a $5 scratch game that features 105 top prizes of $50,000 and overall odds of 1 in 3.26. For more information about this game and the number of prizes still available, visit ialottery.com. Waterloo man sentenced to life in prison for killing friend in a 2022 incident. Dateline Waterloo. Courtney Harris's life ended in a flash when he was shot waiting at a drive-up window in January of 2022. Sentencing for the man convicted of pulling the trigger was over just as fast on Monday. Eugene Octavius Love Jr., 21, declined to address the court or offer any comments as he was sentenced to life in prison without parole, the only punishment for first-degree murder in Iowa. He was also ordered to pay $150,000 in restitution. No friends or family of his victim, 18-year-old Courtney Harris, attended. A few relatives of Love sat silently in the gallery. Prosecutors and defense attorneys limited their arguments as the sentence was mandated by state law. Details of the slaying became public during trial in September. Love and Harris had been friends, but had a falling out at some point. The defense said Harris had tried to start a fight with Love outside a Quick Start convenience store on Logan Avenue weeks before the shooting. Love and his girlfriend drove off, and Harris continued to follow the girlfriend even after Love was dropped off. On the night of January 8, 2022, Love reportedly received a message from another female friend claiming that Harris had threatened her with a gun weeks earlier. Love had his girlfriend drive him to Prime Mart on Broadway Street, according to testimony at trial. He had her stop near Harris's vehicle at the drive-through window, then exited and fired at least 4 shots from a 9mm handgun, striking Harris in the head. Harris's vehicle rolled forward and hit a house. The girlfriend and Love drove off. Authorities said Love and his friends burned the clothing he was wearing and then drove to Minnesota, where they buried the gun. Police used surveillance cameras in the area to identify the getaway vehicle and GPS data from cell phones to trace the locations of people Love was with during and after the shooting. During trial, the defense argued Love had acted out of fear, arguing for a lesser manslaughter charge. Former employee accused of stealing from Dollar General store. Dateline Waterloo. A former discount store assistant manager has been arrested for allegedly stealing cash from the business. Waterloo police arrested Ebony Simone Claria Mickey, 25, on Sunday on one count of second-degree theft. Mickey had been an assistant manager at Dollar General, 820 West 5th Street, in 2022, when she allegedly took an estimated $5,795 in cash from the store. Her boss found all of the cash from the store safe missing April 20, 2022. Investigators reviewed security camera footage that showed Mickey placing cash envelopes from the safe next to her lunchbox and then carrying the items to the break room while closing during the previous night. She then emerged from the break room with her lunchbox, locked the store for the night, and left, according to court records. Abducted Iowa girl recovered safely in Indiana due to quick response by state trooper, police say. Dateline Hammond, a 14-year-old disabled girl allegedly abducted by a non-custodial parent in Iowa, was safely recovered this week as a result of the quick actions of an Indiana state police trooper. Police said they received word around 9:30 p.m. Wednesday of an Amber Alert out of Iowa, which is a child abduction emergency alert. Police learned that the individuals sought may be in the area of the Indiana Welcome Center near Interstate 80 and Kennedy Avenue. Trooper Adrian Garcia, who was in the area, spotted the Chevrolet Cruze in question, leaving a nearby Hampton Inn, and initiated a traffic stop, ISP said. The driver, Jessica Ray Williams, 36, from Des Moines, Iowa, was taken into custody without incident, police said. Quote, the 14-year-old juvenile was located safe in the vehicle, according to ISP. Williams was taken to the Lake County Jail, where she is being held for the Des Moines Police Department, and extradition back to Iowa. Quote, the juvenile was placed into the custody of Child Protective Services until she can be reunited with her custodial guardian, police said. Des Moines police issued word Wednesday that the girl, who has special care needs, had been abducted by Williams. Quote, evidence indicates that the girl is at risk while in the company of Jessica Williams, police said. Second Missouri teacher from same school appears in OnlyFans porn. Dateline St. Clair. An English teacher and varsity cheerleading coach at St. Clair High School says she made pornography on the website OnlyFans, marking the second teacher at the school to admit as much in the past month. Megan Gaither, 31, said in an interview with the Post-Dispatch that she was put on leave by the district Friday evening and she expects to be fired after going public. She said she joined the direct-to-subscribers website in May to supplement her teaching salary and help pay back more than $125,000 in student loans. Quote, teaching does not financially support a person, Gaither said. It's really hard to stretch those paychecks during the summer. That's why I did it, unquote. Gaither's total pay last year, including a stipend for coaching cheerleading, was about $47,500, according to the Post-Dispatch public pay database. Gaither's former co-worker, Brianna Coppage, was put on leave and eventually resigned earlier this month after the district was alerted to her OnlyFans account. Since then, Coppage's success on the site has skyrocketed. Her subscription rate has increased more than fivefold, and her story has been picked up by news outlets across the world. Gaither said she deactivated her OnlyFans account, which had about 1,500 subscribers, after Coppage's account was discovered by the district. Gaither said she was making an additional $3,000 to $5,000 a month on the site at the time, but she never showed her face in an effort to remain anonymous. Still, Gaither said, rumors began to circulate at the school when she appeared in a video on Coppage's account last week. The video did not include Gaither's face, but it was recorded at a party in a St. Louis hotel room, and when a photo from the party was posted publicly, Gaither was wearing the same costume that she wore in the video. Quote, I was in like maybe 4 minutes of the entire thing, and I definitely did not think this would be a thing that would ruin my entire career, Gaither said. The district superintendent Kyle Cruz said this week that the, quote, district does not have a statement to issue at this time. He did not respond to a request on Friday for more information about Gaither's employment status and the decision to put her on leave. St. Clair is about 55 miles southwest of St. Louis and is home to about 4,700 residents. OnlyFans, a website that launched in 2016, boasts more than 210 million paid subscribers and more than 2.1 million content creators worldwide. It has garnered significant attention as teachers, judges, lawyers, police officers, and other professionals have created content on the site to bolster their incomes. Performers charge anywhere from $3 to $75 for a monthly subscription, with some users paying more for custom and pay-per-view content. Both Coppage and Gaither said they didn't know the other person who was on the website until June, when Gaither made an offhand comment at a teacher's night at Busch Stadium. That led to more discussion between the two, and Gaither on Friday described Coppage as her best friend. Gaither, who has master's degrees from Missouri Baptist University and Arizona State University, is in her fourth year teaching American and British literature at St. Clair High, which has about 750 students. She has coached cheerleading at the school for 3 years. Gaither said she still loves teaching, and she initially deleted her OnlyFans account when Coppage's account was discovered because she didn't want to risk the same thing happening to her. But rumors began circulating after last week's video, and she said a student on Monday slipped a note under her classroom door suggesting they, quote, knew her secret. Now, Gaither said, her career at St. Clair is over regardless of what I do, unquote. Quote, I legitimately love in my heart for each and every one of my students, she said. The students are why I told myself I would spend 30 years of my life at that school, and I feel like I'm abandoning them. I know I will likely never see them again, unquote. Gaither said she was told by the district that she was put on leave because of professionalism and student communication. She insists she never acted unprofessionally in the classroom and earned good reviews from administrators. Gaither said she and her husband have already talked about moving from her hometown of St. Clair. She said she would likely reactivate her OnlyFans account. Quote, right now, I am just hoping to make enough to support my family, Gaither said. Gaither emphasized that her decision to join OnlyFans was related to low teacher pay, and her decision to go public was not an attempt to piggyback on Coppage's success. Quote, in order to make change, you have to make noise. And I think that is what Brianna did, Gaither said. Quote, and I think that's what maybe I'm getting ready to do. Make noise about how unfair teacher pay can be. Gaither also said she suspects activity on the website is more widespread than people realize, including among teachers. Quote, I wouldn't be surprised if there are other teachers out there in Missouri, Gaither said. Teachers are probably freaking out right now because two teachers from the same school in less than a month have been caught, unquote. Waterloo man arrested for robbing woman trying to run over man. Dateline Waterloo. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly robbing a woman on Thursday and trying to run over a man on Friday. Police arrested Matthew Ray McCarron, 31, of 627 Dawson Street on Friday, and he was charged with second-degree robbery and assault while displaying a weapon. He was also cited for driving while suspended and reckless driving. Authorities allege McCarron was driving his Ford Edge and pulled up to a female acquaintance who was walking home from a store in the 1100 block of Ackerman Street around 10 p.m. on Thursday. He allegedly punched her, knocked her down, and took her phone, cigarettes, and $3 in cash and fled. Then on Friday, McCarron allegedly told a male acquaintance to meet him at Exchange Park around 6 p.m. When the victim arrived and stepped out of his vehicle in the parking lot, McCarron allegedly drove at him in his Edge and tried to hit him, according to court records. He continued to follow the running victim until he was involved in the collision at Burton Avenue and Park Road. Now let's turn to sports news. In high school volleyball, Don Bosco battles but falls in 1A quarters to Holy Trinity. Dateline Coralville. The first minutes of Don Bosco of Gilbertville's 1A first-round match with Holy Trinity Tuesday at Extreme Arena were full of fun and excitement for the Dons. Don Bosco making its second consecutive state tournament appearance, jumped out to a 10-2 lead on the Crusaders. Everything seemed to be going swimmingly, but slowly but surely, a much taller Holy Trinity, which featured three players 6 feet or taller, began to impose their will at the net. In the end, that size advantage aided the Crusaders in a 25-21, 25-17, and 25-21 victory. Quote, "They did a great job of playing defense on their side," Don Bosco head coach Jenny Scherer said. Quote, "I think we got a little frustrated with the balls not going down, and some of our defense was not in positions where we talked about being." Holy Trinity forced Don Bosco into 25 attack errors and a .082 attack percentage in the match. Meanwhile, after hitting .118 in the first game, the Crusaders hit .324 and .286 in the final two games. Mary Kate Bendlidge led Holy Trinity with 11 kills, while Natalie Randolph and Presley Myers each had 9. "They are a big team and a lot bigger than we were. They're just a great team," Scher said. The first game will go down as a missed opportunity for the Dons. With a big lead, Scher felt her team began to panic as Holy Trinity started to march back into it. Leading 16-12, the Dons saw the Crusaders go on a 6-0 run to take an 18-16 advantage. Don Bosco used a 3-0 run of its own to go up 19-18, and Alexis Evan Kill tied the game at 21-all, but a pair of kills by Bendlidge and an ace by Myers helped Holy Trinity score the final 4 points of the game and win it. The first game saw 6 ties and 4 lead changes. Quote, "It did," Scherz said of that game slipping away from the Dons. Quote, "I think we lost our focus a little bit." Even as Kennedy McGarvey led Don Bosco with 10 kills apiece, while Emily Naughton and Grace Phillips had 8 and 7 respectively. Even led the Dons with 17 digs, and Addison Scherz had 34 assists. The loss ended another outstanding season for the Dons, one that saw them at .500 late in the year before they closed 14-1. Don Bosco will graduate just 2 seniors, Even and Naughton. Quote, "It was a great month of October," Scher said. Quote, "We kind of flipped the switch and decided this was the kind of season we wanted to have. The girls played great all month." Quote, "It is tough. You are playing great teams when you are playing here, and we just didn't have what we needed tonight. Proud of the girls and how they played, especially our seniors, Alexis and Emily." Unquote. Number 4 Denver defeats number 5 Sumner Fredericksburg and advances to 2A semifinals. Dateline Coralville. Two trends collided during a Class 2A quarterfinal matchup on Tuesday to help power Denver to a win via sweep over Sumner Fredericksburg and into the semifinals, the first of which was consistent improvement from the 4th-seeded Cyclones, who managed to improve each set in a 25-18, 25-16, 25-11 win over the 5th-seeded Cougars. Sophomore outside hitter Bailey Mullahan, who led Denver with 9 kills in the match, credited the consistent improvement to a particular habit of the Cyclones between sets. Quote, "It is the gummy bears we eat after each set," Mullahan said. Quote, "They just keep pumping us up. When we get pumped, we get real good." Unquote. Haribo is the brand of choice. Red is the flavor of choice. Michelle Mullahan, the mother of Bailey and twin sister Grace, was the one who had the idea to bring the sweet treat for the team at the start of the postseason. It's been a smashing success from there, and one head coach, Jamie Johnson, has no problem with. Quote, "I would feed them granola bars last year," Jamie said. Quote, "If we went past a third set, we are the team eating on the bench. If it's gummy bears, I have no problem with that. Blood sugar is going to be up, and sometimes you just need a little extra kick, unquote. The second trend was a unique oddity born out of two teams' memberships in the North Iowa Cedar League, NICL. Denver and Sumner-Fredericksburg faced off in three separate volleyball matches during the 2023 regular season. All three matches ended in a sweep. The Cougars won the first and third, and the Cyclones won the second. That trend continued on Tuesday as the Cyclones won the fourth meeting via sweep. Following the win, Denver senior Elena Hildebrandt and sophomore Channing Johnson knew exactly what led to Tuesday's result and the odd trend between the two teams. Quote, "It came down to determination from each team," Hildebrandt said. "When we play each other, there is always kind of a chip on the shoulder of who wants to beat who. We have played them so many times throughout my 4 years. Coming in this battle, it was who was going to want it more." Quote, "It's about momentum when we play them," Channing said. "I feel like whoever starts off the strongest is usually the team that takes it all the way. That just happened to be us tonight," unquote. The matchup proved both Hildebrandt and Johnson were correct as the Cyclones fought their way off an early gridlock to take an 8-4 lead in the first set and force the Cougars to burn a timeout. A 4-point run shortly after the timeout for Denver, which included a kill from Hildebrandt, allowed the Cyclones to contain, tightening their grip on momentum with a 13-6 advantage. Sumner-Fredericksburg managed to cut the Denver lead to 3 points twice, but could never come any closer, as the Cyclones won 25-18. Grace and Bailey Mullahan tied for the team lead with 3 kills apiece. The Cyclones picked up where they left off in the second set, leaping out to a 6-1 lead as 4 different players scored. Sumner-Fredericksburg managed to rally to tie the game at 6-6 and briefly traded blows with Denver before a 4-point run by the Cyclones put them out front 13-9, with the Mullahans both recording kills in the run. The Cyclones cruised to a win out of the Sumner-Fredericksburg timeout, taking 12 of the final 19 points to take a 2-0 lead in the third set. Denver saved its best for last, running away with the third set 25-11 to earn a spot in the 2A semifinals. As the final point was scored via a triple block against Sumner-Fredericksburg superstar and Northern Iowa commit Isabel Elliott, who led the match with 12 kills, the Cyclones rushed the court to celebrate the victory. According to Hildebrandt and Johnson, a loss in the quarterfinals to Hinton last season helped motivate the Cyclones on Tuesday and provoked the emotional response. Quote, "Traveling here in the locker room getting ready, everyone is so jittery and so excited," Hildebrandt said. "Coming into this match, everyone wanted it so bad, and everybody showed it," unquote. Quote, "After last year, it is a little bit of revenge that we wanted," Channing said. "Even though it is not the same matchup, we still wanted to beat them very bad." In addition to Bailey, Grace Mullahan recorded 7 kills, and Jessica Gergen notched 6. Johnson dished 29 assists to go along with 4 kills. Up next, the Cyclones face another NICL foe in No. 1 Dyke New Hartford. "If we can play to our potential, I like that team," unquote. And now, listeners, we'd like to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 1st on IRIS, IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now this message.
If you're struggling with your mental health, there's something Your Life Iowa wants you to know. It's all right to feel sad, to be angry, to feel depressed, to be anxious, to feel lonely. Something else that's definitely all right? Getting help for your mental health. When you're ready, Your Life Iowa is here for you 24/7. Find support at yourlifeiowa.org. Together, we can make everything all right. Brought to you by the Iowa Department of Public Health.
Now let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today comes from the New York Times, authored by Patty Davis, and the title is Matthew Perry and the Loneliness of Addiction. Here's a note about Patty Davis, the author of this piece. She's a daughter of President Ronald Reagan and is the author most recently of Floating in the Deep End, How Caregivers Can See Beyond Alzheimer's. A long time ago, I lay awake for hours, terrified that they would be my last ones on Earth. I had committed myself to quitting cocaine, which was my second addiction, the first being years of amphetamines. I was devoting myself to cleaning up and getting healthy. But then a friend called who I had routinely done coke with and who also had a supply of the drug. Earlier on that black night, I careened backward into the familiar land of white lines on a mirror and a heart racing way too fast. It was pounding so hard, so fast, so loud, I was certain it and I couldn't survive. I saw the fact that I did survive as somewhat of a miracle. It would be a nice, clean story if I said I never did drugs again. But addiction is never nice and clean. I did go back and try to clean up my life, and truthfully, I backslid only a couple of times after that, and never as severely as on the night I thought might be my last. I don't think back on those days too often, but with Matthew Perry's death, the memories have coiled around me because of how honest he was about his own addiction. I want to tell you something about addiction. No matter who it is or what substance that person is hooked on, loneliness is at its root. For whatever reason, and I have no theory as to why, there are those of us who feel isolated in this world, as if everyone else had some secret formula for getting along, for fitting in, and no one ever let us in on it. That loneliness resides deep inside us, at our core. And no matter how many people try to help us, no matter how many friends reach out, support us, show up for us, it never entirely goes away. It's vast and shadowy, and also part of who we are. Something happens when we discover a drug or alcohol. Suddenly, we have a companion holding our hand, propping us up, making us feel we fit in. We can be part of the club. It's there for us in the empty hours when it seems no one else is. Quote, "Nobody wanted to be famous more than me," Mr. Perry said at the Los Angeles Times Festival of Books in April. But he added, quote, "Fame does not do what you think it's going to do," unquote. I remember hearing him say that and thinking, right, it doesn't penetrate that loneliness. I wonder if he ever realized how brave he was to reach past his pain and hone a talent that would make people laugh. He discovered alcohol at 14. I was 16 when I discovered amphetamines, and I felt as if I had met my best friend. Suddenly, I felt I was livelier, more entertaining, not the shy, nearsighted girl who felt uncomfortable around people. To understand an addict, you need to appreciate that companionship, that need to reach for what won't judge you, but will instead seem to transform you into who you wish you were. Mr. Perry spoke about being lonely. He wrote about it in his book, Friends, Lovers, and the Big Terrible Thing, and he talked about it in the context of longing for a relationship. I wondered if he knew that even the joy and fulfillment of a relationship don't fill up that insecure place deep inside some of us. When I quit drugs for good, I had to accept that this was just part of who I am. I didn't have to fix it or try to obliterate it. That hadn't worked anyway. I had followed the white lines of coke right back to who I was, the person who felt she needed to use drugs to live. We may never know what Matthew Perry's emotional state was at the time of his death. He had come to terms with the fact that fame made addiction so much harder to bear, but also allowed him to help others through the story of his journey and through the sober living house he created. The best thing about me, bar none, is that if someone comes to me and says, I can't stop drinking. Can you help me? I can say yes and follow up and do it, he said, with Cue with Tom Power podcast. He laid bare his wounds, his struggles, his complicated relationship with drugs and alcohol. That's the best we can do in life. Be truthful and hope those truths become lanterns for others as they wander through the dark. My biggest hope is that he knew he had fulfilled his wish. Next, we have the patent fight that could take Apple Watches off the market. This appeared in the New York Times and was written by Peter Coy. Apple Incorporated sells a lot of smart watches during the holidays, but this year its sales of most Apple Watch models may well drop 100% to literally zero the day after Christmas. That's because of a ruling Thursday by the International Trade Commission that most Apple Watches contain parts that infringe on patents held by Masimo Corporation, a producer of medical technology, and its sister company, Cercacor Laboratories Incorporated, both of Irvine, California. An import ban and a cease and desist order on sales both take effect on December 26th, unless President Biden reverses the decision by December 25th, which appears unlikely. Presidents rarely overrule the independent, nonpartisan agency, which was founded in 1916 as the U.S. Tariffs Commission. I've been talking to people from Masimo for months about the ITC case and other cases they have going against Apple. I didn't write anything because I wasn't sure how strong Masimo's arguments were. Now that it has scored its victory against Apple, the world's most valuable company, I think it's time to open the reporter's notebook. Masimo argues that Apple's reputation for innovation is undeserved and that the company has made a practice of efficient infringement, using other companies' technologies without permission and dealing with the legal fallout as necessary. The company points to something that Steve Jobs, Apple's co-founder, said in 1996, quote, Picasso had a saying, he said, good artists copy, great artists steal. And we have, you know, always been shameless about stealing great ideas, unquote. Apple, of course, rejects this characterization and says the company respects other companies' intellectual property. In Apple's defense, it's fair to assume that Jobs was speaking metaphorically about not copying to a crime when he said that the company stole. On the other hand, Masimo has presented evidence that before launching Apple Watch models with competing technology, Apple hired the chief of medical officer of Masimo and the chief technical officer of Cercacor and then started looking, quote, the next level down. Apple opened offices near Masimo's and, according to Masimo, eventually hired more than 20 people from Masimo and Cercacor. Let's back up. Masimo, while not a household name, is a recognized world leader in patient monitoring technologies for hospitals. It has been possibly the best light-based pulse oximeter, which uses red and near-infrared light emitters and detectors to see how red and thus how oxygen-rich the blood in the arteries is, partly thanks to software that efficiently extracts signal from noise. Masimo's pulse oximeter works even when patients are moving around or when they have a weak pulse. By using it on premature infants with underdeveloped lungs, hospitals can give them precisely the amount of oxygen they need. A good thing, because too much oxygen causes blindness. It's also good for patients on heavy opioids who sometimes stop breathing because the opioids dull the pain they're supposed to feel when they don't catch a breath. It's agreed by both sides that Apple sought a meeting with Masimo when it was exploring adding pulse oximetry to the Apple Watch. Apple signed a confidentiality agreement. A meeting was held in 2013. At this point, stories differ. Joe Chiani, the electrical engineer who founded Masimo in 1989 and remains its chief executive officer, told me on Friday that Apple decided that rather than pay for the licenses to use the technology, to do a joint venture, or buy Masimo, Cercador, or both, it decided to do strategic hiring of key employees. Apple says it concluded that Masimo's technology wasn't suited for a consumer device, so it went in a different direction, although, of course, it did hire those key Masimo employees. Apple finally introduced its first watch with pulse oximetry in the Series 6 in 2020. It has incorporated pulse oximetry into all its smartwatches since then, with the exception of the cheaper Apple Watch SE. That means Apple will have to stop selling all its watches except the SE model starting on Christmas Day, unless something happens before then. Either the companies can cut a deal, the U.S. Trade Representative's office recommends to Biden that he reverse the ruling, or Apple persuades the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals to stay the injunction while it considers an appeal. The ITC case is only one front, the battle between Masimo and Apple. In 2020, Masimo sued Apple in federal district court in California, alleging theft of trade secrets. The suit ended in a mistrial in May when the jury deadlocked. The case is being retried. Last year, Apple sued Masimo in federal court in Delaware, charging that Masimo was the one doing the illegal copying and was trying to knock Apple out of the market to make way for its own watch. Masimo counterclaimed that Apple had infringed its patents, falsely advertised its watch's capabilities, and violated antitrust and fair competition laws. In a separate action this September, the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the Patent Trial and Appeal Board's invalidation of some of Masimo's patent claims, but rescued others. So, a lot going on. Chiani told me that his company has spent more than $60 million on its legal fights with Apple. He said he thinks the ITC ruling in Masimo's favor will help the company in other jurisdictions, even though it's not binding for them, because the ITC is a reputable agency that did a deep dive into the allegations. Quote, the same patents Apple was found to have infringed at the ITC are also at issue in Delaware District Court litigation, the company wrote me in an email. The administrative law judge for the commission said she found no significant evidence that Apple's patent infringement was the result of copying. Masimo responded in its email to me that her ruling has no bearing on its claim of trade secrets theft in the California case, since trade secrets, quote, are not disclosed in Masimo's patents at all. Masimo has been moving into consumer markets with products including the W1, a smartwatch that competes with the Apple Watch. Neither company has yet received approval from the Food and Drug Administration to claim its product is suitable for medical use. Chiani argues that Apple's technology is inferior and has given pulse oximetry a bad name with customers. Apple decided to provide an executive to speak on the record. The company's position is that Masimo is pursuing a strategy of litigation over innovation, hoping to generate a fresh stream of royalties because royalties from past litigation have dried up. Apple points out that the federal jury that deadlocked in May was 6-1 for Apple, indicating that Masimo was a long way from making its case. This fight is far from over. Quote, my goal isn't just to beat Apple, Chiani told me in an interview last summer. It's to get Apple to change its ways, unquote. Next, we have a piece by Paul Krugman of the New York Times titled, Auto Workers Strike a Blow for Equality. It's not officially over yet, but the United Auto Workers appear to have won a significant victory. The union, which began rolling strikes on September 15th, now has a tentative agreement with Ford Stellantis, which I still think of as a Chrysler, and finally, General Motors. All three agreements involve a roughly 25% wage increase over the next 4.5 years, plus other significant concessions. Auto workers are a much smaller share of the workforce than they were in Detroit's heyday, but they're still a significant part of the economy. Furthermore, this apparent union victory follows on significant organized labor wins in other industries in recent months, notably a big settlement with United Parcel Service, where the Teamsters represent more than 300,000 employees. And maybe, just maybe, union victories in 2023 will prove to be a milestone on the way back to a less unequal nation. Some history you should know. Baby boomers like me grew up in a nation that was far less polarized economically than the one we live in today. We weren't as much of a middle-class society as we like to imagine, but in the 1960s, we were a country in which many blue-collar workers had incomes they considered middle-class, while extremes of wealth were far less than they have since become. For example, chief executives of major corporations were paid, quote, only 15 times as much as their average workers, compared with more than 200 times as much as their average workers now. Most people, I suspect, believed, if they thought about it at all, that a relatively middle-class society had evolved gradually from the excesses of the Gilded Age, and that it was the natural end state of a mature market economy. However, a revelatory 1991 paper by Claudia Golden, who just won a richly deserved Nobel, and Robert Margo, showed that a relatively equal America emerged not gradually, but suddenly, with an abrupt narrowing of income differentials in the 1940s, what the authors called the Great Compression. The initial compression, no doubt, had a lot to do with the wartime economic controls, but income gaps remained narrow for decades after these controls were lifted. Overall income inequality didn't really take off again until around 1980. Why did a fairly flat income distribution persist? No doubt there were multiple reasons, but surely one important factor was that the combination of war and a favorable political environment led to a huge surge in unionization. Unions are a force for greater wage equality. They also help enforce the outrage constraint that used to limit executive compensation. Conversely, the decline of unions, which now represent less than 7% of private sector workers, must have played a role in the coming of the second Gilded Age we live in now. The great decline of unions wasn't a necessary consequence of globalization and technological progress. Unions remain strong in some nations. In Scandinavia, the great majority of workers are still non-union members. What happened in America was that workers' bargaining power was held back by the combination of a persistently slack labor market with sluggish recoveries from recessions and an unfavorable political environment. Let's not forget that early in his presidency, Ronald Reagan crushed the Air Traffic Controllers Union, and his administration was consistently hostile to union organizing. But this time is different. Research by David Author and Annie McGrew shows that a rapid recovery that has brought unemployment near to a 50-year low seems to have empowered lower-wage workers, producing an unexpected compression in wage gaps that has eliminated around a quarter of the rise in inequalities over the previous four decades. The strong job market has probably encouraged unions to stake out more aggressive bargaining positions, a stance that so far seems to be working. By the way, I constantly encounter people who believe that the recent economic recovery has disproportionately benefited the affluent. The truth is exactly the opposite. the political ground also seems to be shifting. Public approval of unions is at its highest point since 1965, and Joe Biden, in a presidential first, joined an auto worker picket line in Michigan in September to show support. None of what's happening now seems remotely big enough to produce a second Great Compression. It might, however, be enough to produce a lesser compression, a partial reversal of the great rise in inequality since 1980. Of course, this doesn't have to happen. A recession could undermine workers' bargaining power. If Donald Trump, who also visited Michigan but spoke at a non-union shop, returns to the White House, you can be sure that his policies will be anti-union and anti-worker. And Mike Johnson, of the new Speaker of the House, has an almost perfect record of opposing policies supported by unions. So the future is, as always, uncertain. But we might, just might, be seeing America finally turn back toward the kind of widely shared prosperity we used to take for granted. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, November 1st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we record. Just go to our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.